Cumulative Risk Assessment Seminar Series this is the ninth in the series and will be presented by Dr. Mary White of EPA's Region 5 based in Chicago. The seminar will be focused on ecological conditions at landscape scale, but the approach and principles can be applied to the full range of scopes of cumulative risk assessment, such as to a human subpopulation in a small urban neighborhood. Also, as a piece of the 10-part seminar series, it is one more perspective on how to address cumulative risk. With the implications, complexity, and varied statutory opportunities and requirements presented by cumulative risk, EPA is attempting to examine as many angles as possible. Dr. White obtained her PhD from Louisiana State University in the Department of Oceanography and Wetland Sciences. Her topic of study was the landscape scale modeling of wetland processes. She has participated in numerous field studies in the wetlands of southern Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico during her subsequent employment with the Coastal Ecology Institute at LSU. Dr. White has been an environmental scientist at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Region 5, for 11 years. During that time, she has worked with the Critical Ecosystems Team, the Water Division, and now in the Lands and Chemicals Division. Dr. White.
Thanks, Chuck. Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. I'm going to slide 2, where I'm going to start. This work began when our then regional administrator asked the then Critical Ecosystems Team to come up with a way to determine the highest quality areas in the region and how to communicate to regional programs some of the ways they could use that information. This request was made to assist us in developing measures for goal 4.3 in the then GIPR goals. I'm emphasizing then because this is an old product, and but it has merit even today. Slide 3. The first attempt at locating critical ecosystems was to visit the federal and state natural resource managers in all 6 states of our region: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio, and asked them to help us map the areas that were important to them. This slide shows the final mapping product from this partner-identified ecosystem effort. This was a beneficial exercise because it introduced the team to the partners who were very familiar with their areas and allowed opportunities for collaboration in geographic initiatives. The map shows the priorities of our partners and the interests and investments that they have. A concern that the team had was that this method lacked independent scientific validation. We thought a more rigorous analysis would be necessary in order to be sure the work was scientifically grounded. We began to look for a systematic and defensible way to recognize or measure critical ecosystems. Slide 4. After many meetings with a number of ecologists from various programs sitting around a table, the team arrived at 3 criteria. This is science by committee, and it's similar to a root canal, painful but thorough. Criteria had to be able to be populated with data layers that were consistent in time and had been collected in the same way throughout the 6 state region. We arrived at 20 data layers that populate the criteria, and the team believes can quantify a critical or significant ecosystem. Each criterion will have a summary score, and the 3 scores added together give an ecosystem assessment. Slide 5. We used as our base map the National Land Cover Database. This satellite imagery is from 1992. It was classified as 30-meter pixels, and it's available for the whole United States. The 30-meter pixels were aggregated by majority to 300-meter cells. Because we were trying to evaluate critical or significant ecosystems, we removed from consideration anything that was developed in any way. The map you see here is of the study area, and although difficult to discern at this scale, the white areas are either agriculture, urban, or industry, and have been removed from the analysis. Slide 6. Many of its data layers were evaluated by ecoregion. For example, when land cover rarity was evaluated, the land cover was summarized by ecoregion to avoid comparing northern Minnesota to southern Illinois. We used Omernick Level 3 ecoregions in this analysis because in our area of the country, Omernick and Bailey regions are very similar, and we decided to stay with the associations that had been done by other ETA analysts. Slide 7. Because there were different numbers of data layers for each criterion, the composite scores had different ranges. Diversity and rarity, shown diagrammically left and right, could potentially range from 0 to 400. Sustainability could potentially range from 0 to 1200. In order to require the three criteria were equal in weight, the composite criteria layers were normalized from 0 to 100. The final result then would be four composite layers at the cell scale. Three individual criterion layers, diversity, sustainability, and rarity, and a composite ecosystem significance layer whose cell score could range from 0 to 300. I'm going to go through these data layers as quickly as I can, but I wanted to give you a feel for the types of data that we use. In order to characterize diversity, we have four data layers. They're shown diagrammatically here as strips, where on the left a score of 100 meant higher diversity or better area. On the right, lower diversity or worse quality area. The 30-meter land cover type was summarized into 300-meter cells with Shannon-Wiener diversity index calculated on the land cover type. That was the first one. The higher the score, the higher the Shannon index, the higher the score. A 10-year average temperature and 10-year average precipitation was calculated by the National Weather Service. These were provided to us as contour maps. We overlaid the ecoregions onto these maps and picked out the areas within each ecoregion that had the highest rainfall and temperature. These were the areas that we hypothesized would have the highest diversity. The appropriateness of land cover was calculated by using the Kukler potential vegetation map and the categories of land cover. The categories of land cover were crosswalked onto the Kukler vegetation categories. When the land cover matched potential vegetation, we considered the cell had persisted for a longer period of time. If not, then if they differed, the potential was for a lower score. The fourth one is contiguous sizes of undeveloped areas. The cells of undeveloped land types were merged into polygons of undeveloped lands regardless of the land type. The larger the undeveloped polygon, the higher the diversity. In a number of these, the difference between the highest and lowest score was many, many orders of magnitude. Contiguous size of undeveloped area is an example, and once the metric was calculated, we took the log base 10. When I say log from now on, I'm always going to be talking about log base 10. Slide number 9. Now we're talking about sustainability as a criteria, and we based it on what we thought were two major factors, fragmentation and stress. Here I'm going to go over the fragmentation metric. The first one was area to perimeter calculation. The second was water bodies that were created by impoundments. We located all of the dams and then searched for open water in the near vicinity. If there was open water in the vicinity of the dam, then it was considered to be impounded. The third is the road density at 10-kilometer scale. The fourth, contiguous area by land cover type. Now, that's different from the one in the previous metric. This is by land cover, and so these are necessarily smaller polygons. And five, with the appropriateness of land cover. Again, we use the Kukler vegetation maps to crosswalk onto the land cover type. Slide 10 is the other half of the sustainability, and that these are the stress layers. One was proximity to airports within a buffer zone around the airport. Two is proximity to Superfund sites. Three is proximity to active RCRA hazardous waste cleanup sites. For number four, we ran the basins model on all six states and at eight-digit HUC level. We ran the model for nitrogen, sediment, and oxygen. And the higher the oxygen, the lower the sediment, and the lower the nitrogen, the higher the water quality for that basin. The higher the nitrogen, the higher the sediment, the lower the oxygen, the lower the score for that basin. Five, exceedances of air quality thresholds as predicted from the OPPT air risk model. Six is the number of dams per HUC, and seven is proximity to urban or developed areas. So what I've given you here are two slides that have 12 different data layers to characterize the disturbance levels or the stress levels. Slide 11, rarity layers were characterized by four data layers. The land cover rarity by ecoregion. So the ecoregion, the Amarnik ecoregion maps were overlain with the land cover map, and the categories of land in each ecoregion were summed, and the rarest land cover type was considered the highest number for that metric, the most the highest what's the word I'm looking for? The most common land cover types were given the lowest score. For these next three criteria, the data was derived from confidential business information from the Natural Heritage Program. The data was summarized by 7.5-minute quads, and this is the only consistent rarity data we could find. Remember, this was done before NatureServe was available. We calculated species rarity by quad, the number of rare species in a quad, and the number of rare taxa in a quad. Okay. Slide 12. The Science Advisory Board has issued guidance on essential ecological attributes. This guidance was not released until late into our assessment process, so we couldn't benefit from using it. In retrospect, we did do a crosswalk with our data layers and their essential attributes. The columns show our criteria. The rows show their essential attributes. The only essential ecological attribute that we totally missed was a measure of ecological processes, something very difficult in any analysis, and particularly at a large scale analysis. I want to show you a few of the sustainability layers to illustrate how the layers were combined. When I say that four layers were combined to give us diversity, 12 to give us sustainability, and four to give us rarity, this is the way we combined these layers. This slide shows the airport results. The original data shapes were the files of runways. These were buffered by an amount based on the sound level of the that the airport produced. The data was then coded as 0 for inside the buffer and a 100 for outside the buffer. This was then converted into raster format at 300 meter scale. All right, slide 14 shows you the water quality layer. After it was summarized at the 8-digit HUC analysis, every cell in the HUC was assigned the value associated with that. 15 gives you an example of the air toxics layer. This analysis was done by census tracts, which ranged in size from 0.025 hectare to over 600,000 hectares. Every cell in the census tract was assigned the same value. To summarize a criterion, all of the data layers associated with it resolved into 300 meter cells and normalized to from 0 to 100 were added together. The developed areas were masked out. No weighting was applied to these data layers. This decision was made because providing unequal weights could introduce larger artificial biases than the errors they were intended to alleviate. Slide 17 shows you our results. The three frames at the top show diversity composite, sustainability composite, and rarity composite. The scores for diversity range from 0 to 397. The scores from sustainability range from 464 to 1157. The rarity scores range from 0 to 331. If we add those together, we normalize those individual criteria scores to 0 to 100 and added them together for a final ecosystem score. The range is 23 to 253. Remember, the possibility is from 0 to 300. The range is from 23 to 253. And the mean score in our region was 139. Slide 18 shows you a blow-up of the map to give you a feel for the detail that is associated with this once you drill down in the scale. You can visualize on the right-hand side, the darker the red, the higher the quality of the area. The lighter the red, the lower the quality of the area. And the white is data that's been, land cover that's been masked out because it's developed in some way. Slide 19. This is a frequency plot of the final composite scores. The x-axis is the ecosystem score, which potentially could range from 0 to 300. The y-axis indicates the number of cells that have that score. On this plot, I've indicated where that mean of 139 falls, as well as the top 10 and 1% of all the scores in the region. Slide 20. It was never our intent to use the scores as a ranking mechanism, but rather as a rating. With that in mind, we attempted to evaluate uncertainty in the predicted ecosystem significance scores by investigating the frequency distribution shown at the top left of this slide. The center plot is the change in count versus the change in score. That is the first derivative of the frequency. It's evident from the first derivative that the cells below 75, identified as the group F, are the class of the lowest in the region. Cells with scores above 210, identified as A, are the highest. Dividing the rest of the scores into categories is a bit more problematic, but suggested categories might be 76 to 121 is an E, 122 to 164 is a D, 165 to 189 is a C, and 190 to 210 is a B. This is based on where the derivative completes the cycle and identifies a discrete peak or subpeak in the frequency distribution. These categories correspond well with the analysis by percentage. The top 0.1 cutoff score is 222, residing in category A. The top 1% is in 198, residing in category B. The top 10% cutoff score is 170, residing in category C. Slide 21. This is a color-coded map, coded to reflect the scoring presented in the previous slide. Perhaps a different nomenclature should be used since A through F system is so often associated with academic grades. So if you can remove that from your mind, you'll see that in this case, in fact, category D contains the average ecosystem score and the most prevalent group of scoring in the region. Slide 22, the number of cells of each rating is shown in this bar graph. Note that the y-axis is a log axis, again log 10. Until predictions can be validated at a finer scale, we feel we can at least use the results at this resolution. So how do you validate such a large-scale spatial model? Well, one is best professional judgment. In our committee, we discussed prior to seeing any results that if generally acknowledged superior areas in the region did not score well, the results would be suspect. Statistical analysis. In a moment, I'll show you some statistical analysis that doesn't validate the model, but it sheds light on the assumptions of the criteria and data layers. The ideal way to validate this model would be if we could provide in situ measurements of diversity, sustainability, and rarity at randomly distributed cells across the study area. We were working on a scope, on a version of that very thing with a RARE grant, but the results were mixed. It's beyond the scope of the project today to delve into that. If you're interested, though, please get in touch with either Charles, Maurice, or myself. We can give you more information. Instead, we have examined the CREAM scores in areas known anecdotally to be ecologically high quality, again using best professional judgment. Slide 24. In this slide, the cells shown in red are those that have composite scores in the top 1% of all the scores of the region. Circled are areas that are known to have high quality, usually protected areas within national forests or state parks. As you can see, there's a good agreement in this overlay. This correspondence occurs despite the fact we did not use the boundaries of parks and reserves as a data layer. Slide 25. Because the data layers are equally weighted and there are no parameters or coefficients to tune and validate, it's important that none of the data layers within the criteria duplicate each other. In other words, within diversity, the data layers that go to comprise that should not duplicate each other, or you will be double counting that particular data. The diversity composite, when we ran Kendall correlations on this data, the diversity composite, the highest correlation is 0.41 between land cover diversity and patch size of undeveloped land. Within sustainability, the highest correlation is 0.45 between weighted road density and development disturbance buffers. And finally, within the rarity composite, the highest correlation is 0.52 between rare species abundance and taxa abundance. None of these are exceptionally high correlations. With a N of over 3 million, the P is 0.0001, indicating that if any of the individual data layers were omitted, information toward the final scores would be lost. We could not use factor analysis to determine the individual contributions of each layer on the final score because a number of the layers were not continuous. That is, a number of the layers were scored either 0 or 100, rather than continuous distributions between 0 and 100. We've concluded then, based on this analysis, that the individual data layers within a criteria do not duplicate each other. Slide 26. Another important consideration in using the composite criteria is that they measure separate characteristics and are not confounded by interactions with other criteria. The highest correlation between any two criterion is 0.40. Thus, the highest variability explained by any two layers in combination is only 16%. From this, we conclude that each composite score does indeed measure a different set of information. The Kendall correlations for the interactions between criteria, as well as their correlations to the final composite score, are shown. Diversity and sustainability contribute more to the total composite score than does rarity. Another way of validating a model like this, I said earlier, was peer review. We did have in June of 2004 an SAB review, and the results of that are at this website. And subsequently, we have published this in a peer-reviewed journal, and the reference for it is given you at the bottom of this slide. So the only thing left to do, if we were going to be terribly rigorous, is to try to do a validation in situ. And I'll briefly discuss something that we worked on. Again, if you're interested in it, get back in touch with either Chuck or myself. We had two workshops to develop and test protocols that would do a quick assessment of forest, non-forest, terrestrial, wetlands, and lakes. By a quick assessment, we meant a 300 by 300 meter parcel by four people in 4 hours. We contacted the National Heritage Program in each state to get a list of sufficiently large areas to assess and their corresponding EO rank. The EO rank is given as excellent, good, or fair, or ABC. We awarded a contract for the actual field assessment of about 80 of these sites chosen at random from the universe of sites supplied by National Heritage Program. The results of this field verification was mixed. The work produced what we think is a useful quick analysis methodology for ecosystems, but the scores did not correlate well. Two factors complicated the validation attempt. The field work was done in 2004 and 2005, whereas the data is from 1990. And the registration of such small cell sizes made it different to be certain where on the ground the actual cell was located. The quick assessment protocols were published by ORD in an ORD report. And again, if you're interested, contact one of us, and we can point you to the publication. So we have a model. It's predicted some results. We have some confidence in those results. What are the proposed uses? Well, first and foremost, slide 29, the tool was developed as an assistance in internal EPA decision making. So our audience is EPA. If portions or all of the analysis can be used by our partners, so much the better. Slide 30, this again is the frequency distribution of scores. On the y-axis, the number of cells. On the x-axis, the composite scores, which can range from 0 to 300. The distribution in blue is the result from the model with the 1992 land cover database. If the analysis were rerun when 2000 data became available with the corresponding 2000 conditions in the data layers, the distribution would undoubtedly be different. Suppose the red distribution were the results of the 2000-year analysis. We could say that our poor quality lands were indeed improving, illustrated by the portion of the graph marked A, and the region would have lost areas of higher significance, illustrated by B. The mean for the region for the undeveloped land would probably be lower than it was in 1992. To be sure, if the scores are different in 2000, it is not solely due to the activities of EPA. Many of the ecological conditions reflected in this model are under the oversight of others. for example, urban sprawl. But the information would be a holistic evaluation of the ecosystem condition and a further evaluation of what was responsible for the increases and decreases that would give EPA a way to evaluate our progress in protecting that condition. Slide 31. We could use this information to help prioritize program activities. This version of the results shows the region in gray. The top 10% composite scores are in blue, top 1% are in yellow, top 0.1 are red. This information might be used along with other appropriate factors to help in determine the priority of processing investigations, enforcement actions, awarding grants, and assigning workloads. Slide 32. The National Environment Performance Act, NEPA, reviews could benefit from this information. In this case, an airport expansion in La Crosse, Wisconsin was being reviewed. The analyst was assisted in the review by knowing where federal land was in relation to the most significant ecosystems in the area. Because the model uses existing data, and most of that data is available nationwide, this methodology is easily transferable to other areas. Slide 33. For every cell, there are three independent scores, one for diversity, one for sustainability, and one for rarity. If these scores are plotted against each other, the scatter plot can give us information that can be used as a type of ecosystem risk analysis. On the y-axis is the normalized diversity score ranging from 0 to 100. On the X is the normalized sustainability score. The top right portion of the plot shows cells that are high in diversity and sustainability. These areas are not experiencing high stress and may, in fact, already be protected. The lower left portion shows cells that are low in diversity and low in sustainability. It may be that these are already so degraded it would take intense resources to restore them. But at the top left portion of the plot shows areas that are high in diversity and low in sustainability. These high diversity areas are experiencing high stress and can be targeted for additional protection by program activities or by additional assistance through grants. Two notable areas fall directly into that last category. They are the Indiana Dunes in northwest Indiana along the shore of Lake Michigan, and the confluence of the Minnesota River and the Mississippi River just southeast of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Slide 34 shows that area. Purple lines are the interstates that bound between cities. From the top north, northwest, you see the Mississippi River coming in. It's joining the Minnesota River right in the center, lower bottom, and then it's making a curve north and then south again. The area in red, circled in red, is very high diversity, very low sustainability or high threat, and could be targeted as an area for protection. Slide 35. In 2002, the Texas Environmental Resource Stewards was formed, TERS was formed. This was a group of state and federal agencies whose leadership saw the advantage of early planning and collaboration for ecological protection on large construction projects in Texas. After reviewing a number of ways of evaluating ecosystem quality, they decided to adopt the Supreme methodology. Using data appropriate for Texas, they have produced this analysis that they have agreed will be used in the evaluation of all large construction projects. In addition, the EJ tool that is being evaluated now in Washington used the same type of methodology of adding data layers, normalizing them, coming up with areas that indicate the possibility of EJ interest in the area. Slide 36. There are many sources of data and many collaborators in this study. And these are just a few of the people and divisions that were represented and contributed, and I thank all of them.
Very good, Mary. Thank you for an excellent talk, and we'll open up the phone lines now for questions on the phone, and we'll alternate between the phone and those questions typed in over the Fluin website. So, any questions on the phone? Okay, well, Gene, do we have any questions on the Fluin website?
Yeah, we actually do. We have a question that was submitted online from Oklahoma, and they ask, was the change from 1992 to 2000 due to controllable change, such as land change, decreased in WQ or AQ?
Well, the slide that I showed, and I can't tell you right now which slide number it was, the slide that I showed that compared the two was a hypothetical slide. This is slide number 30. It's a hypothetical response. Our region's leadership has changed since this was first done, and they didn't see fit to do the 2000 analysis, so we don't actually have that. I was presenting this as a possible way of using the results if you should choose to do the 1992 and the 2000 and subsequently the upcoming, I think it's 2006 that's going to be available. So the answer to that is, although this is a hypothetical situation, you could drill back down and find out whether it would be water quality or air quality that was the cause of the change, and then that's how it could be very useful to you.
Okay, great. This is just a gentle reminder to those of you who are online streaming the audio. If you have a question that you'd like to ask the speaker today, simply click the question mark icon which appears at the top of your screen. If you have a pop-up blocker on, you'll want to disable that because that'll allow a new little form to open up so you can type up your questions. But while we're waiting to see if any other online questions come in, those of you on the phone lines, if you've muted yourself, you will need to hit, #6 to unmute your phone if you'd like to ask a question vocally. So are there any phone line questions that we didn't get to? Again, #6 to unmute your line.
Hi, this is Rick Hertzberg in Atlanta. On the last, next, I guess it was the last technical slide, which is 35, you have, I got confused with the numbers here. Is the 1 to 99, and it says 100%, and then 100 to 126 is 50%. Are those good numbers or bad numbers?
It's
kind of related also to the color scheme chosen, where red is usually the flag that says, pay attention to me first.
Right. This is the analysis that the state of Texas did, and what shows here is that from 1 to 99, the value of the color being very light, that's the ordinary distribution of, I'm thinking that's the ordinary distribution of the most common land, and that 193 to 270 are the higher quality lands. That would make sense around Big Bend, but I'm not seeing anything showing up in the Austin area, which I would expect. This is the results of their analysis. I think, though, that you're right, that the reddish color is saying, pay attention to me. These are the higher quality areas.
I found that interesting for cumulative risk assessment because often we think, well, the lowest quality, most desperate situations are the one needing attention first. And it looks like here with your color scheme that you're saying, no, let's go the other direction and say let's preserve the really good stuff. And if it's already wasted, like some of the areas in the Mediterranean that have just sort of been written off, then we won't spend resources on the waste areas. We'll just go for the protection of the good stuff. Is that right?
In their case, the Texas Environmental Resource Stewards were trying to come up with a map that everyone in this, every agency in the state would agree on, and so they had representatives from every agency, the Corps of Engineers, the Highway Department, the major cities, and what they wanted to do was map out the highest quality areas and agree that if they were going to do major infrastructure, they were going to avoid those high quality areas. So what you choose to apply the interpreted results to will vary based on what you're interested in. In their case, they were interested in where can we put roads without disturbing things, where can we put dams without disturbing things. Particularly, they were worried about the alignment of some east-west and north-south interstates. But if they had chosen instead to say, well, where should we decide to restore, then they might have chosen their number scheme differently, their color scheme differently, and picked out different areas. Similar to the way we did when we picked out our top 1 and 10% areas. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
I'd also like to add that again, this as Mary said, this was a study done by Texas and the Texas state agencies and federal agencies involved, and they did not use the exact same layers in their analysis as we did. They used some of the same layers, but they used their own layers. This was a matter of a transfer of approach and methodology, so that they were not trying to duplicate the cream that we have done in Region 5. They were tweaking it for their own purposes, which is great. And, it's just a way of, they were taking the approach of that we use in terms of combining different layers and different databases that they were interested in relative to the questions and management decisions that they needed to make.
As an example, in the Texas case, they used Bailey ecoregions because that's what they, the whole suite of people dealing with it were comfortable with. They did not use the dams layer because there was no, their conclusion was that there was no water body that was a natural water body. So everything was an impounded dammed area that was open water. And the third was that they used elevation as a diversity indicator. And in our region, we're quite flat. We don't have the differences in elevation that could imply differences in diversity, whereas they do. So as Chuck said, this is an example of how the methodology and the types of analysis can be tuned to a particular area of concern or particular project.
I have a question on the phone line. This is Marilyn Ten Brink from the Atlantic Ecology Division, and this is some very nice work. And I had my question is directed at the application. I was wondering what kind of response you have had from the partner organizations that helped you identify ecosystems in the first place, and how comfortable are they with the temporal and spatial scales?
We've had good acceptance from our partner agencies and organizations. What they like is that their areas are showing up, and it validates what they're interested in. The temporal scale is a problem because we did it only for the 1990 through 92 time period. And since National Land Cover Database is one of the fundamental layers, you can only do it as often as that comes out. We have 2000, which it would be wonderful to be able to do it again for 2000, and soon we have 2006. It would be even more wonderful to do those too. But we haven't really gotten any feedback on the temporal. the spatial, they're not terribly uncomfortable about the spatial. They understand that the idea here was to try to compare within a large region. Thank you.
Mary, this is Andrew. There's an emerging area, eco-services, kind of asks the question of how environmental quality and human health or human services interact. This tool deliberately doesn't use developed areas and doesn't range developed areas. What would be needed, or is this tool adaptable to consider eco quality or critical environments in developed areas?
You're right. It's a different kettle of fish in that sense. It's one of the things that made me think that the essential ecological services or attributes that the SAB gave us, we don't have ecological processes characterized anywhere. And I think because of that, from this, it would be very difficult to draw ecological services out of it. The fact that agricultural and urban land has been taken out of the analysis, and the fact that ecological processes are not clearly inserted into this would make it difficult to take this and translate it straight into services. However, having said that, I think that it wouldn't be hard, having gone through this one time, to sit down again and come up with data layers that would characterize services, and cornfields provide this amount of service for food production. Cornfields provide this amount of detriment to the environment through applications of nitrogen. Cornfields, and then summarize it in an analogous way. Ecological services.
I think the next question gets back to the direct linkage there needs to be between the starting point, which is the risk management question and goal, and the assessment, that they have to be related to each other. That the senior managers in Region 5 at EPA at the time wanted to the answer of find me where the areas of best ecological condition are in the region so that we can step up our efforts at protecting them. Texas took on the same type of methodology but used it in their own way to answer their own management questions and management objectives, and so they modified the tool in the way that they wanted to. Likewise, Andrew's question on harmonizing human health and ecological considerations and getting into ecological services. It's a different question. The tool could be used, or the general approach could be used that was used in the cream, but again, you would be using, as Mary has pointed out, different layers of information that would reflect what the management question was. And again, it's sort of one of the themes at EPA is that we're really trying to line up our assessments and our analyses with the management goals and questions, because that sometimes in the past has not occurred. And then you come up with an answer at the end of the analysis, and the managers say, "So what? That's not what I was interested in." So we want to try to link that bridge.
And I would reiterate that although it's adaptable and Texas took out some layers and put some layers in and whatever, if that's done, I still think the statistical analysis needs to be done to show that those are not duplicating data sets
and that the criteria are still orthogonal and that they are, in fact, not measuring the same thing. They are measuring three distinctly different things. Otherwise, you're inadvertently weighing your data layers.
Jean or Jim,
yes.
Any more questions that typed in through the instant messaging service?
Yep. There were a few more that were submitted online. The first one's coming in from DC, and it's a multi-part question regarding slide 10, the proximity to SF's RCRA and urban areas. What counted as proximity? For Superfund and RCRA, it seems to be just in and out of boundaries. Is that correct? For RCRA, are these all TSDFs or just the corrective action sites?
For RCRA, they were just the corrective action sites, and in fact, they were just the active corrective action sites, not completed ones. It looks as though they are the specific boundary, but in fact, they have been buffered by, I think it's 100 meters on all sides. As a before we would buffer something, or before we would use any number, we would require that someone came up with a reference for that number. And so, although you may feel like, well, it's larger than 100 meters or smaller than 100 meters, we did have some reference somewhere that said that disturbances from cars going in and out and different kinds of activities taking place were felt 100 meters away. And so those were, when we used buffer zones around urban areas or airports or NPL sites, those were all 100 meters.
Okay, and the next part of that, for proximity to urban areas, again, I think you're answering it, what was the actual distance, and was this to a lat or long point?
Was this to a lat or long point?
Yes.
Latitude or longitude?
These were polygons that were then buffered with a 100-meter buffer around the polygon, and then the resultant larger polygon was given a score and then decomposed into 300 by 300 cells. Does that answer that question?
I think that does. The next question comes in from Florida, and they ask, how was cell size determined?
Well, it was started with the land cover database with 30 meters. Couldn't go any smaller than that. Did we want to go larger than that? From a computational point of view, we did want to go larger than that. It was difficult to identify a size that was optimal. There is some sensitivity analysis that's done on the National Land Cover Database by Jim Wickham that says that the percent of error drops dramatically if in the identification of that land cover type if you go to 10 by 10, in other words, the 300. And so that computationally and from a point of view of error analysis, we thought that that would be the good compromise.
Okay, great. The last question I have online is coming in from, it looks like, Indianapolis. And they ask, how were managed forests classified in the analysis? For example, were plantation pine forests and regularly harvested forests classified as quote-unquote natural or quote-unquote agricultural?
Yeah, that's a very good question. To the extent that we could identify them as agriculturally oriented, we called them agriculture. But in particular, pine forests are very difficult to do that. And so probably most of those went into the forested category. The forested category, however, was listed as deciduous, coniferous, and mixed. So if you're finding coniferous in an area where you wouldn't expect it, you probably could expect that might be a plantation forest. But we decided to just let the data run the show, you know, and so if it showed up as forest,
unless we had good information that said otherwise, we called it forest.
Okay, great. That's the end of the online questions so far. If there are any last minute or remaining questions, again, try to type them up as quickly as you can. If we don't have time, the speaker's contact information was included on the homepage for today's event, so you'll be able to follow up with email to speak with her if you have questions that weren't addressed today.
I would like to just add a little bit onto what Mary just said, that one of our ground rules when we were working on this project was that we were going to use data and databases that were already or that were available, that we were not creating new data. And for that, in terms of the forest data, we could have further processed that information, but we were using the previous analysis that was done on the national land cover, and using and taking their classification as what they were. So we didn't go back in and reclassify their classification. And that would be true of other layers as well.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mary. That was terrific. So this concludes today's teleseminar. Again, in 2 weeks, Tuesday, July 14th at 12 noon to 1:30 p.m., we'll have the final teleseminar in this series. Anna Lowett of the Office of Pesticide Programs and Ginger Moser of the Office of Research and Development will present Approaches to Pesticide Cumulative Risk Assessment, Policy, Practice, Experimentation. 2 weeks after that, the workshop on Advancing the Science and Practice of Cumulative Risk Assessment will be held in Chicago. That's July 28th through 30th, beginning at 8 a.m. on July 28th. To register for that seminar, go to the workshop website. If you haven't received that information, please contact me, Andrew Geller, or Charles Maurice, David Herr, Timothy Barzik, or Patty Tyler. Thank you very, very much again, Mary, and thank you all for listening and participating. Thank you.